오마게나 스마란다스야 제만제나슈라카야 착수른무담예나 스마이 쉬브레 나마 반차카우파트루브제스차 비파신두 바에그차 पतितानं पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभुनित्यानन्द श्रियाद्वैतगदाधर शिवासदिगौरभक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 रामो राम राम हरे हरे। So greetings from the Sun Falls, Gunnison Falls, where I stay. Lot of opportunity for sharing the sacred teachings of India. I can see that. Out of the blue, I got invited to the what's it called? The Boston Yoga and Chant Fest. They just asked me that they'll give me an hour to speak on whatever subject they want and give me a space. I can meet and greet people, sell books, raise funds, otherwise give space people to meet me. So, and they'll provide me accommodations, and so pretty nice opportunity. Also, yesterday in Princeton, I got word from several people, quite exciting, that. Radhanath Swami had a program called East Meets West, which was kind of with Cornel West, and Cornel West is one of the most brilliant African American spokesmen and scholars. By the way, I have terrible reception up here, so there is a chance that my phone could drop the signal. I think it's a little better in the evening, so I do have good reception on the computer. So if somehow I'm go off, people can inform me. But you know, I spoke to one of the organizers, and they said it was just phenomenal. I spoke to several people that were there. That Cornel West would speak; he's so articulate, and then Radhanath Swami would reference what he's saying from, you know, the teachings of the East, and that there was so much affection before them, and that even Cornel West paid his obeisances to Radhanath Swami. So I was kind of thinking in terms of the study of the Yoga Sutras, that when someone is nonviolent or has perfected nonviolence, then people cannot be aggressive before one. And I would have to say that Radhanath Swami has really cultivated internally that kind of mood to never offend anyone. I remember one time in Vrindavan, I was complaining about the monkeys, and you know, I thought it was cute. He defended the monkeys. He said, you know, what can they do? We stole their, you know, their forest, you know. So I think he has that mood, and I think it's having an effect wherever he goes in the public sphere with people, and we're certainly very proud and happy that someone in our tradition is able to represent the tradition in such a powerful way that really some of the substantial intellectual leaders are appreciating his humility and knowledge. Now, I thought, you know, I'm going to continue this class. I have some inkling at a particular time to present the Narada Bhakti Sutras. The Yoga Sutras are popular, but this is the Narada Bhakti Sutras, and to prepare something on that. In the next few times we meet, it seems practical. I think it's been fairly working that I'm just going to speak on subjects I'm speaking about. So I'm going to speak a little bit about Bhagavad Gita today and how I've been approaching it. And then read a few verses and highlight some points. And I hope it'll be interesting. I've been giving a bi-monthly Bhagavad Gita class at the local yoga studio here in Hudson. And I've been trying to, you know, sum up. And now I think previously here I've highlighted Arjuna's crisis. And, you know, there's a lot of suffering. And when an intelligent person suffers and see suffering legitimately, even in the Yoga Sutras, as a learned man sees suffering and happiness, meaning he understands that whatever happiness that one gets is in the context of the body, and the happiness one feels in terms of the body absorbs one in the bodily platform of life. Especially if it's done in a unrestricted way, in a way that one experiences the suffering of the body more. And generally, that saying is that an ounce of suffering is experienced more intensely than a ton of happiness. So generally, Bhagavad Gita shows with Arjuna's dilemma that an intelligent person is eventually going to look for his happiness beyond that platform. And if he's intelligent, he won't artificially renounce that platform, but he'll purify that platform. He'll make sure that he's happy and satisfied to a reasonable degree on that platform, but with the objective eventually of transcending that platform. And then the question comes in an intelligent mind is wanting to progress towards some type of moksha or liberation, being in this particular situation that I am facing, what is my duty? And that's how the Bhagavad Gita basically starts. Arjuna is in a crisis where he sees only suffering on the platform of the body. And he's facing a particular choice that he has to make. And he's trying to ascertain what is the best choice I can make to help me progress towards the ultimate goal. So he wants out, but he wants to know what his duty is. And therefore, Arjuna gives various arguments. Now, the concept of duty is a little bit complex, because what your duty is depends on what you are eternally, but it also depends on what you are now. And therefore, one man's food or duty is another man's poison, in one sense. I mean, one person's duty is celibacy, and another person's duty is having children. You know, that may be their duty to have children. They got married. It's their duty to have children. And if you don't, you're not doing your duty. And another person it's a little bit complex. That's why in a proper culture, one must have a guide who's conversant in the sacred texts and who can therefore guide one appropriately in various situations according to the sacred texts. They have realization so that they can apply knowledge. They can see a principle operating in a unique circumstance, a different circumstance than perhaps where that principle is even applied in the Shastra. They know the principle, and they know the principle well enough to see it wherever it arises, in whatever situation it arises. So Arjuna becomes confused. And he's trying to figure out what his duty is. So what I'm going to read is a part of the Bhagavad Gita which makes a very essential point. If you want to understand what your duty is in any circumstance, the foundation of making that choice is to understand the soul. And if you don't understand the soul, you don't have the basic calculation to make any other proper calculation in your life. Prabhupada gives the example, 1 + 1 = 3, and no matter what you do, you're going to fail. So therefore, and Srila Prabhupada stressed it, the Bhagavad Gita stressed it, you really have to understand the relationship between the body and the soul. Because that's the objective, to understand that. No matter what you're doing in life, the decision you make, whether it's renunciation or whether it's attachment, that decision is based on the fact that it will bring you closer to the soul. Even if it's a slow path, even if it's a quick path, even if it's a supportive path, whatever decision you make, it has to be connected to the soul. And in the bhakti tradition, to the prema of the soul, to the love of Godhead that one is seeking. And everything is secondary. But it doesn't mean things are not important. Everything you do is secondary. It doesn't mean you give up everything. But it means if there's an ultimate conflict between something and out, and it doesn't give you, it's not leading to prema, then the path that leads to prema, the love of God, it is more important. But a person even satisfies his attachments because he, as a devotee, whatever it is, I have to take care of family, this is my desires, whatever it is, I'm a businessman, I can't help but work, I'm an artist, I have these inclinations to create. Even if the impulse is coming from the material platform and one has to satisfy it, one is satisfying it because it is in the strategy to realize the soul. So let me go through these verses. And I'm going to text 11. I'll read about 10 verses. I hope you'll enjoy it. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, while speaking learned words, You're mourning for what is not worthy of grief. Those who are wise lament neither for the living nor the dead. So Arjuna had some type of politics, sociology. He argued on the basis of various religious principles. But because his calculations were not based on the soul, the Prabhupada said, because he was lacking in that knowledge, he should not have posed himself as very learned. And therefore, he was lamenting for that which was not worthy of grief. And here, our Krishna, as the teacher, he chastises him, because sometimes, the teacher chastises the student to help remove the bodily concept of life, sometimes the pride, but gently. One cuts the false ego, but doesn't kill the person. So he's while speaking Pragya Vadams means talk, very intelligent talk. Nanu Sochni Pandita. While speaking learned words, you're not really learned, because you're not understanding the nature of the soul. That's the basis, the calculation. Just like, people are attached to their families, fine. And that may be healthy for them to a certain degree. It may satisfy their desires. It may make them peaceful. But if you think that those are your eternal relationships, and therefore prioritize them in a way that's above the understanding of the soul, to the extent you get in your 90s and you practically can't function, yet you think that your house is your eternal abode, your family is your eternal associates, and your particular form in that body is your eternal spirit, is your eternal reality, then it's unbecoming. Then it's unbecoming. It's very interesting. He says, to ultimately access Dharma, one has to take into account the soul. And because Arjuna didn't, Krishna is chastising it. Now, I thought this point is very, very interesting. The wise lament neither for the living nor the dead. And I kind of analyze that, because that can appear that a saintly person is not compassionate. But he is compassionate. Para dukkha dukkhi. The saintly person, he suffers for the suffering of others. Paradukha dukkhi. When it says he laments, neither laments for the living nor the dead, it means he doesn't lament for that which is inevitable. And it's inevitable that one changes the body. That one can change. But whether or not you identify with it as the self, that's up to you. What is ignorance defined as in the Yoga Sutras? When the impure, when one takes the pure, the eternal, one takes this, when one thinks that the self, which is eternal, pure, and happy, and one thinks that the eternal, happy, I'm kind of tongue-tied today, but I'll say it again. Ignorance means to mistake the eternal, blissful, pure soul for the temporary suffering, impure body. That's up to you. So the learned don't lament that one's changing the body. That's inevitable. But they lament that someone is identifying with that and therefore suffering. One second. Just like I'm visiting my 90-year-old mother regularly, and she's been blessed with exceptional health. But 90 is 90, and the old age is being felt. And with that comes the fear. So, of course, there's some attachment, and that's also natural. But my main lamentation is not that my mother will change bodies. I may be attached. I may have some sentiment. That's fine. But the main lamentation is not that. The main lamentation, the wise lament neither for the living nor dead. We don't lament for that, but you lament that people are identifying with the body. And because they're identifying with the body, they will fear and suffer the illusion of non-existence called death. So because Arjuna, in his calculation, whether he should fight or not, was not understanding the soul, therefore he was chastised. Okay, next verse. Never was there a time where I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. So Krishna is affirming the eternality of the soul, but not only affirming the eternality of the soul, but affirming the eternal individuality of the soul. Not only should you not lament when the soul is changing bodies, but your identity will not be annihilated. You will still exist individually. And this is by far the majority view of Indian philosophy. And Prabhupada, in the purport, I'm not going to really get into that now, but, you know, really dissects, you know, any objection to the fact that this verse is indicating eternal individuality, that it's not in the future you merge, but in the future, Krishna says, you, kings, nor in the future, we will not cease to be individuals. So Krishna is affirming that very, very strongly. And he's not talking about a platform of ignorance, because he's also, otherwise, he would not refer to himself. Because if Krishna himself, if that's a platform of ignorance, then what would be the use of his teachings? Now, Krishna, it's a very beautiful section. Krishna will give the basic understanding of the difference between the body and the soul. The basic understanding that there's a collection of bodies, and therefore it tests that we are different than them, because we are a particular person. And through our life, we experience different bodies. That there's many bodies in our life indicates that the person or who we are is different than the body, because we had a body the size of a pea in our mother's womb. We'll have an old person's body. The body is changing, but there's a consistency, and that is the observer or knower of the body. This is a very famous verse in Bhagavad Gita. I'll say the Sanskrit. Dehino smin yatha dehe komaran yovanam jarat yatha dehetra praktya des tatanu. As the embodied soul continually passes in this body from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into an other body at death. A sober person is not bewildered by such a change, because the sober person is not identifying. It's not only he's not intellectually identifying with the body, but he's actually realized he's not the body to the extent that he does not feel or suffer the transformations in the body. That's called Diras Tatya Namuyate. When my spiritual master, His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, was coming to leave the world, I was there in Vrindavan. There was about 15, 20 of us in his room. When he came in to leave, I can pinch myself now. I cannot believe I was sitting in the presence of such a divine personality. I was sitting in his presence. And he said to us, what is death but a change of body? And then he quoted this verse. And it says, Diras Tatya. Diras means sober. A sober person, Muyate, is not deluded. The body is changing. He's not deluded. Oh, I am dying. Oh, I will not exist. That's an illusion. He's not in that illusion. And I saw that because I was at Srila Prabhupada's bed when Srila Prabhupada also died. I was at his bed. He was not bewildered. His consciousness was completely steady. He chanted at the time of death. He was not the least bit fearful, because he was living within the soul. I saw a great god sister of mine who dedicated her life to Krishna consciousness. In fact, her father, I think, was the director of the Peabody Museum in Harvard. Very wonderful lady named Gauri Das. And I was at her bedside. She chose to die on the floor. She had so much faith in Vrindavan. And I saw that this Ayurvedic doctor who initially gave her medicine that put the cancer into remission, I saw that Ayurvedic doctor come in 1 hour before she's about to leave. We didn't know that. He felt her pulse, and he said, you have an hour left to live. You have an hour left to live. But then, at the same time, he said, disease is gone. That's what he said. Disease is gone. You have an hour left to live. So the person was an elevated soul, the Ayurvedic doctor, and the meaning was it was disease is gone. And what is the disease? It's the ignorance. The ignorance of thinking the temporary body is the self. That's the disease. The other transformations are actually happening in matter. They're not happening in you. The actual disease is the ignorance. So he understood, basically, she was liberated. An hour left to live, she was informed, and she knew she was going. And I remember we were chanting with such intensity, I was holding her Radha Krishna deities at her side. And I saw she was transcendental. She looked up and she said, "This is intense. Can you bring yourself to that point? It will happen in your life. By your practice, will you have been realized?" Great Vaishnava and Sanskrit scholar, Dr. Fakir Mohan, came to my festival 2 years ago. And some of the young Sanskrit students at the Govardhan School, they come to my festival. And he looked at them. And he said, "Who is Shastragya? Who knows the scriptures?" And then he said, "One who practices them." So will we have applied this knowledge to an extent that it will become our vision? So when the body dies, we will not be in the ignorance that we are dying. Very powerful instructions. Now, the next verse, Krishna will continue to show that you're not only different from the body, you're different from the mind. The mind is constantly changing. It's only the feelings that you're having of disease and hot and cold and all these things, they're only happening due to your sense perception. It's only how you're seeing them. It's not actually what is actually happening. It's due to your sense perception only, and they're relative. Happiness and distress is relative. And by tolerating those things which are arising from ignorance or sense perception, then we will actually get the realization and knowledge to rise above the ignorance. So here's the theoretical thing, you're not the body. And then the practical thing is if you apply that knowledge, then you tolerate the distresses that come in terms of your duty. I should do this, but I don't stop doing it because there's dualities that I'm experiencing. There's discomforts that I'm experiencing. I continue to do it. I continue to do it. I tolerate those when I do my duty. This is called tapasya. Despite the irrational impulses of the mind and senses, I continue to do my duty. And therefore, whatever duality comes, whatever suffering comes, it inspires the consciousness to become extracted from the material body. So it says, "O son of Kunti, the non-permanent appearance of happiness and distress and their disappearance in due course are like the appearance and disappearance of winter and summer seasons. They arise from sense perception, O Sian of Bharata, and one must learn to tolerate them without being disturbed." And what's the result of that toleration? O best among men, the person who is not disturbed by happiness and distress is certain, steady in both, is certainly eligible for liberation. So when you tolerate, the irrational impulses of the mind and service, and you're steady. Steady in what? Steady in whatever duty you are to perform. Then that gives you the kolpate. You're considered eligible. Now Krishna is going to tell Arjuna what a seer of the truth has understood and what Arjuna has not understood. This is what one, because Arjuna is saying, he's speaking learned words, but Krishna is saying, no, you want to know what someone who actually sees the truth, what he concludes? The seers, those who are seers of the truth, have concluded that of the non-existent, there is no endurance. And of the eternal, there is no change. They have concluded this by studying the nature of both. So the non-existence means there is no endurance. That means that which is temporary is not real. The body is not real. It's not that there are not elements there, but the concept that it is a person is a imposition. It's an imposition of the mind. It's not that there's not something there, but it's not a person. The body is not a person. It's not real. It's just constantly changing. What's not changing is that there are elements. There's energy. There's a conservation of energy. But what's changing is elements. And therefore, that's not the self. It's not real. What's real is what's eternal, and that's the soul. So Arjuna, get real, Krishna is saying. Get real. Act on what's real. And don't neglect your duty based on some misconceptions. Now he says, he'll show, nasate vidyate bhavo, nasate vidyate sataha. Nasate vidyate sataha. The previous, for this verse, said, of the eternal is no change. Okay? So 17 will deal with that part. It'll speak about 16 described the Siya. The Siya said two things. The eternal is no change, and of the unreal there's change. So now he's going to give an example of both. So of the real, there's no change. He explains, that which pervades the entire body, you should know to be indestructible. No one is able to destroy that imperishable soul. So the symptom of what's real, the symptom of yourself is consciousness. And the symptom of consciousness is the life that pervades the whole body. That's consciousness. You know, our particular soul, the consciousness ends with our body. You can look at yourself now. Look at your hand and put it near an object. You are not conscious of that phone or whatever, or that book or that phone that's near you, because you have not projected your consciousness into it. Your consciousness ends with your particular body. And that consciousness that pervades your body, that's the soul. And no one's able to destroy it, Arjuna. So don't stop fighting in this battle with the misconception that you will end people's existence. You will not end people's existence. Do your duty. Don't stop on the basis of misconception that you will end their existence, because they are the souls. And then the material body. That's of the indestructible, immeasurable, and eternal living entity is sure to come to an end. Therefore, fight, Lord Arjuna. Don't stop on the basis that you think that you are, you know, the body is sure to come to an end anyway. If you do your duty, this is a point in Bhagavad Gita, it's very subtle, but if there is universal interest, if there is the will of the divine manifest through the sacred texts, through the sacred teachers, or through your heart, and you actually contact universal interest, if you follow that universal interest, it will be universally beneficial to everyone. When you do your duty, it's best for everyone. And even Arjuna fighting in the war, it's best for everyone. So the conclusion is, neither he who thinks this living entity, the slayer, nor who he thinks, nor he who thinks it's slain is in knowledge, for the self neither slays nor is slain. And now Krishna will clearly delineate the eternality of the soul. For the soul, there is neither birth nor death at any time. He has not come into being, does not come into being, and will not come into being. He is unborn, eternal, ever-existing and primeval. He is not slain when the body is slain. Such brilliant points, one after another. And with this knowledge, Arjuna, you can act as a kshatriya. Because how can a person who knows the soul is indestructible, eternal, unborn, and immutable, kill anyone or cause anyone to kill? First of all, you're not. If you're doing your duty, then you're not the cause. You're not the cause. The young child goes across the street because he's obedient to his mother, and his mother says, pick the flowers, and then someone comes out and tells the child, why did you pick the flowers? The child is not the cause of that, the mother is. So when you do your duty, when you link with the universal principle, the cause of your activity is the absolute truth. It's the absolute truth. Now, Krishna deals with subtle points. Arjuna thinks, still I don't want to deprive them of the happiness of these bodies. Okay, I don't want to take these bodies or in these bodies or happy in this body. But what does Krishna say? As a person puts on new garments, giving up old ones, the soul simply accepts new material bodies, giving up old and useless ones. From that absolute consideration, they're better off. It's not cruel. They're better off. Someone is going to get, the body is old, you'll get a new one. If you're thinking in terms of the bodily concept, I don't want, you know, let them stay in these bodies, you'll get a new body that's better if that's your consideration. And then Krishna just starts honing in so Arjuna understands the eternality of the soul in relationship to a kshatriya. He tries to destroy things, but the soul can never be cut to pieces by any weapon, nor burned by fire, nor moistened by water, nor withered by the wind. And again, he says, the soul is unbreakable, insoluble, and can neither be burnt nor dried. He is everlasting, present everywhere, unchangeable, immovable, and eternally the same. It is said that the soul is invisible, inconceivable, immutable. Knowing that, you should not grieve for the body. However, you think the soul or the symptom of life will be born and like that, but you still have no reason to lament. Krishna said, now I explain from a worldly view. if you don't believe it is so, or you believe or if you think that the soul is the body, you still have no reason to lament because it's just chemicals. And if you think you can save them, you can save them, because one who has taken his birth is sure to die, and after death one is sure to take birth again. Therefore, in the unavoidable discharge of your duty, you shall not lament. All created beings are unmanifest. I'm just going to read the last three verses. In the beginning, manifest in their interim state, and unmanifest again when annihilated. So what is their need for lamentation? Some look at the soul as amazing. Some describe him as amazing. Some hear of him as amazing, while others, even after hearing, can understand him at all. Amazing. Little spark of consciousness is powering the body of an elephant. How God can harness energy, an infinitesimal spark can power an elephant. It's amazing. Therefore, conclusion, he who dwells in the body can never be slain, therefore you need not grieve any living being. Okay, a little Bhagavad Gita today. Anybody like to say hello? Can someone just say hello so I know I wasn't speaking to the wall?
Jai Maharaj, Hare Krishna.
I'm sure, right there. There must be other people there.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. I had trouble unmuting my phone.
Okay, I figured that was the case, you know?
Yeah.
I figured that. Okay. Let's see. Okay. Okay, Vrajradi, I'll see you next week. There's a program, anybody wants to come, at Vrajradi's house at 4 p.m. on week from Saturday. Anybody else like to say hello? Okay, we can finish for today then. Thank you all. Don't you want to stop?